This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to this episode with Brad Schoenfeld. If you haven't heard of this man before, he's basically the guy when it comes to muscle hypertrophy and training science myths. And he is, well, when it comes to like respect in the industry, he's like up there, like he's in the same circle as Lane Norton, same circle as Brett Contreras.
Jesus.
Alan Aragon, Jesus Christ himself. So a guy like this, if you haven't heard of him before, you're just going to be pumped with his information. Yeah. Unfortunately, Raph, I'm not sure where you were. You didn't get a chance to interview
him. I can't remember, but I'm absolutely missed out because we've been trying to set this up for ages. We nearly met him in the US.
That's right.
Because he's like, if you ever heard, we had our Mountain Dog episode, one of our most popular episodes on the MMP. Mountain Dog, the bodybuilder, and he was like
John Meadows.
Yeah, John Meadows. He was like, "This is the number one guy you got to speak to about hypertrophy."
Yeah,
and John Meadows knows hypertrophy.
Yeah,
the motherfucker could barely fit in our studio.
he's full of hypertrophy. He's been practicing hypertrophy for a long time. Yeah, so it was a really good conversation with Brad. I had a ton of questions that I wanted answers. It goes into all kinds of muscle science. I know it gets a little bit nerdy for some people, but I think you're really going to appreciate it. We always bring it back and bring context around how it can kind of help the average person in their training. And it's just one of those people where, look, if he's, you know, if what he's saying, you're kind of like, you know, some people they say and you're like, oh, is that even true?
Or yeah.
Is that kind of thing? Brad's like the guy where it's like, it's true.
It's true.
Yeah. Just trust me, it's true. So it was an honor to get to speak to Brad. So Brad, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it. And guys, of course, today is brought to you by something that hasn't left my wrist since we've got it.
Mm.
It's the Whoop Band. And it has, I've had a lot of interesting things to say now that I've been using it for like 5 or 6 weeks.
Yeah.
No longer. So, this thing gets smarter the longer you use it, which is the best part about it, right? So, in the beginning, I'll be completely honest. First 2 or 3 weeks, I'm like, it's like it's good.
Yeah.
But it's not got a lot different to other things.
Yeah.
But what I started to notice now, the longer I've been using it, this thing is like, it knows me so well.
Yeah.
So, because you answer subjective things on it and you answer stuff like, you know, did you share your bed? Did you have caffeinated drinks before bed? Did you read? Did you not read? All these sort of things that you answer that takes 20 seconds to answer every day after you sleep or when you wake up. It starts giving you more information like, hey, did you know that when you share a bed, you sleep 9% better or whatever? Mm. So, that's really interesting information for me because it just lets me know as well now that I'm giving it out to my clients that they're going to be having stuff in there where you can be like, hey, look, when it says you have caffeinated beverages past 12 p.m., your sleep decreases by 23%. And that just brings so much more awareness to like, hey, it actually really does affect sleep, even though you feel like you slept better.
Man, like same thing. My client, I'm just like, hey, make sure you get this Whoop Band. They just walk in the gym. I'm like, cool. I can see your recovery. I can see your sleep. I can see everything. Like there's no bullshit. I'm not like, hey, how'd you sleep this week? I'm like, how'd you sleep? And then I look at their phone. You know? You get, and now that I've been using it longer as well, I get like weekly summaries on how my performance was in the week. I get a monthly summary about how I compare to other males my age. Like it's...
Yeah, that's the interesting.
Man, it's getting crazy. It's getting crazy. I think it's like really, really worth giving a go, particularly as like it's really affordable now on their subscription model. And we have a discount code for you.
Yeah. So, if you use Mind Muscle, you get a 15% discount on the first 12 months, I believe. So, it is a very exciting offer. They just launched in Australia as well. So, if you're in Australia and you've looked at it and you're kind of sitting on the fence, this is a great opportunity to get this discount now. I'm not sure if it'll always be around, but 15% is really generous. We're pumped about it. I'm actually pumped. I want to get a bit more of a pimpin' band. I know we've got the black ones.
Yes, 100.
Dude, there's one and it's like white band with a gold clip. I'm like, that's the pimp band. That's
all my members have been like showing me up now that I come in with these sick bands.
Oh, they're coming out with different, they're wearing different colors.
Different colors. Well, I didn't even know what it was. I was like, oh, what's that? Like it's Whoop. I'm like, no.
Yeah, dude. I want to have like a different band. So like when I go out on Saturday night, because you don't want to take it off, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So you go out to a nice dinner or whatever, or you go out to an event and you're like, you want your gold Whoop band on. Yeah.
When Floyd Mayweather gets one, I want to see what he gets and then I'm going to get that.
So whoop.com. is how you guys can access this product. And then Mind Muscle is going to get you the discount.
Awesome. And then our other sponsor of the show is the only supplements we take, True Protein. And man, True Protein, this is like with Whoop, the other thing that is involved in every single day of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. The bars is, it's one of those things where it's like so hard to give up the bars now that we've started.
Yeah.
The only way I stop is when I run out. If they were available in like, convenience stores and server
game
stores.
Game changer.
I would actually have to factor it into my lifetime budget for the year. Dude, I would be having that at least twice a day. At least twice a day. No, if you guys have not picked up the True Protein bars yet, that's the number one recommendation right now. Salted caramel is my flavor. Raph, you like the chocolate.
Yep.
TrueProtein.com.au when you check out MindMuscle10 and you can get 10% off that box. Just buy a box. Share them around. If other people like them, obviously you can get them to chip into the next box. Mm. But if you just really like it yourself, then you can just... They need like a box subscription.
Just don't tell anyone and keep buying.
Guys, TrueProtein.com.au, MindMuscle10. Get yourself some True Protein bars.
Awesome.
All right, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. Today, I'm without Raf. He's taken a much-needed break from the gyms and life. But I'm joined by another researcher, another scientist in the studio. This is what I like so much about these podcasts is I get an opportunity to kind of just kind of get one-upped on all the myths and all the research that I do myself and get the, I guess, the playing field leveled in terms of just having someone on the show that can really kind of lay it all out in terms of what the most recent research is, what the evidence is, what's bullshit, what's not bullshit. This man is Dr. Brad Schoenfeld. I think that's how I say it. And I wanted to start this because, Brad, recently I had been, I kind of swapped out training at my own gym to training at a local sort of commercial fitness aquatic center gym. And it's always refreshing to go into a place where no one knows what they're doing and kind of see what stuff is still popular in the mainstream, in the gen pop. And I was having a few conversations with different people, and I'm talking about people in their 60s, 70s, you know, retired. They're just kind of cruising around the gym. And then I'm talking to young kids, you know, 16, 17, it's their first year lifting. They're all excited. They don't know what program to do. They're asking me all sorts of questions. And then I've just got people who are, you know, in their 20s and 30s as well, professionals. And again, asking me lots of questions. But the one thing that did come up a lot was they were talking about building muscle, right, and losing body fat. And they all said to me, you know, I think even before I had a chance to kind of answer their question, they go, I think I know what it is. I think it's genetics. And I almost wanted to say, well, don't even start thinking that way, because if you start thinking that you have some inherent ability to do and not do something, you're starting off on the wrong foot. You want to believe that you can do everything. And that's kind of the best way to approach fitness in the beginning. To not really think you have a limitation and just kind of get after it. But it did make me think, when it does come to genetics, what do we know are the things that we've studied in the research that it's like, okay, these things are genetic limiters?
Well, genetics are going to always play a major part in terms of your ultimate potential to build muscle.
Of course.
And to get lean as well. There's been a good amount of research on this, and roughly anywhere between 50 to up to 80% of baseline muscle mass is genetically predetermined. The phenotypic response, meaning how the genes are expressed once you start training, it's somewhat less than that. But let's even go with that 50% where your ultimate potential is going to be limited by 50% of who your parents were. That means 50% is lifestyle, other lifestyle factors, training, nutrition, rest, sleep, recovery, et cetera. So, and stress, of course, is a biggie. So there's certainly a huge amount of variability in terms of what you have. So what I would say is that if you don't have good genetics, you're probably never going to be Mr. Olympia. Mm-hmm. But I have never, and I was a personal trainer for many years before becoming an academician, and I never trained someone. I trained literally several thousand people over the years. Never trained anyone who didn't have the ability to put on more muscle. Now, again, some people have the ability to put on more muscle than others, but everyone has the ability to gain muscle, and really all you can do, you can't change who you were, who your parents are, so ultimately you look to optimize what God gave you.
Hmm. And so in that, so taking someone that doesn't put on muscle very easily versus someone who puts on muscle just by like bumping into dumbbells, what are the differences there? Now, muscle protein synthesis, we've explained this on the show before, but you could probably dive into that a little bit. But I've heard essentially how it works is that window in when you create the adaptation, you create the stimulus by resistance training to the muscle, that window in which you can,
well, basically the frequency window before you have to pick up weights again to keep stimulating that muscle. In people that are very genetically gifted, that's a much larger window in which the muscle stays in that state where it's constantly trying to repair and build. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily wholly true or if there is some truth to it. Maybe you could help explain kind of that muscle protein synthesis window.
Well, muscle protein synthesis is the process by which muscle proteins are created and used for building lean tissue, muscle. But what you just said, there really is, that is a hypothesis, or could be a hypothesis, but there's very little research into that aspect of genetics, that some people just can train that more frequently. Like how that's the gene expression aspect is not very well understood in terms of what capacities are. We just know that people who have are genetically beneficial to putting on large amount of mass are able to do so, like you said, by almost bumping into weights, by not doing as much. Now, there's been several studies that have tried to look at what factors are involved, and I'm not sure how technical you want to go, but there are things like satellite cell. Mm-hmm. So people who are genetically benefited in that respect have greater capacity to activate what are called satellite cells, which have been shown to be a primary factor in putting on muscle mass. And trying to put it simply, satellite cells are muscle stem cells which add nuclei to tissue. One of the main factors that they do is to add nuclei to muscle tissue. And nuclei are kind of the protein factories that help to build muscle. So by adding on more satellite cells, by enhancing satellite cell activation, you enhance the ability to produce more proteins, protein synthesis. But there's other things like the ribosome biogenesis. Your ribosomes are where proteins are translated from the nucleus. And it's been shown that people who are genetically gifted, I think would be the way that the best phrase there, have greater ribosome biogenesis. But then it comes down to, is it the chicken or the egg? Do they have a greater ability to increase satellite cell activation and ribosome biogenesis? Or is it the fact that they're producing more muscle proteins forces the body to do that and other factors? So we just don't know these things. And what I don't think is that we can pin down a strategy, people who are genetically gifted should be doing this or that.
Right.
I do think that there are things that people who are not genetically gifted tend to have, need more of. Number one, that's calories, a calorie surplus usually. People who are hard gainers usually are required to take in more calories, perhaps more protein. Certainly they need to watch the amount of protein that they're taking and optimize that. Increasing volume seems to be a factor in those who we have some research to this effect, in those who are hard gainers, there are some people who do quite well with lower volumes, but it seems to be that there are less people who are poor responders when volume gets higher. But again, these are in short terms. It's not
right.
This is why I want to really have a caveat here, that it doesn't mean just go train with huge volumes, but that you need to be cognizant that that is a strategy that can be utilized to enhance muscle growth. Frequency is a possible variable that can be utilized. But usually most of the research points to, and certainly from my own anecdotal experiences, that frequency tends to be more related to increasing volume, that you use that. It's not just training more frequently in an equated volume standpoint, but that adding on more days of training to increase the total volume seems to be a strategy. And there's other factors as well. I mean there's so many things that potentially can be done, and this is where the astute fitness professional needs to use their ingenuity. And some people seem to do better with higher reps versus lower reps, and vice versa, going to failure more or less. So there's so many aspects that seem to go into this that ultimately, it comes down to experimentation. Everyone is in it. The literature and the research gets you into a ballpark. It's going to give you guidelines as to what to do. But ultimately, after that, everyone is in N equals one, and you need to experiment and find out what works for that given individual. And like I said, when I was training people, when I was a personal trainer, that was my ultimate goal. I would have people that for periods of time they wouldn't be gaining, and I would be changing things around using my expertise, and ultimately you find what works.
Mm. Oh, that's so beautifully said. I love that. I love how you said the research gets you into the ballpark, and then it's an N equals one. It's so true. There's absolutely things that you can rule off, and then yeah, there's just like this whole set of things where it's like, okay, volume, sets, exercises, yeah, nutrition, all that just becomes so individual. And anyone who's just kind of making blanket statements out there, either one, they're probably selling you something, or two, they just have only trained like 15 people and they've done it online, so they've never done it in person. I had a question about like people that are kind of overfat or just like overweight in general. They come into the gym and obviously their first goal is to lose weight. Right. And where most people start them, where most trainers in the industry start, they go, okay, we're going to do high reps, we're going to do light weights, or we're going to do circuits, or we're just going to run, or we're just going to basically thrash ourselves on the cardio machine. And, you know, I've always been of the belief that everyone can use more muscle mass. Like if you look at all the research in longevity and aging, it's very helpful to have more muscle mass going into the later years of life. And so I just think to myself, well, we should just start this muscle building journey now. In the case of you taking on like a client, you probably had overweight clients as well. What's the kind of what kind of training do you start with them when it comes to weight loss?
So the first training that I go through with them is called the push away, and that is where you push away your plate when you're going to eat that extra food, because nutrition is going to be the overriding factor. You cannot out-exercise a bad diet or eating too much, ultimately, because ultimately losing body fat and losing weight comes down to energy balance, which is calories in versus calories out. And exercise is a part of your calories out. There's other aspects to the energy expenditure equation. But just looking at the exercise, it's very difficult to – you can eat a lot of food. But to burn a lot of calories through exercise requires a lot of exercise. So it's just much easier to accomplish energy deficits, which is what's required. You need an energy deficit to lose weight through a reduction in calories and food intake. Once that is established, the program generally is not so. Some people will do better having at least some cardiovascular. Certainly, cardiovascular exercise is going to help. Resistance training to me is always a number one in terms of what needs to be done, but it's really not for burning calories. It has to do more with maintaining muscle. Whereas if you're not lifting weights and you're just dieting, a lot of, or at least the fair amount of the fat loss is going to come through a reduction in muscle proteins. So the body will start to leach muscle proteins, catabolize them to utilize as fuel during your energy deficit. And resistance training not only reduces that probability, but you can actually build muscle. You can have body recomposition. I've seen it over and over, both anecdotally as well as in research and other labs that I know have done carried out studies, but we've carried out studies on this, and many labs have, and you just see it all the time. You actually can have body recomposition, and that has to do with resistance training. So resistance training, yeah, you're going to burn some calories. Yeah, it's going to help with an energy deficit, but the few hundred calories that you ultimately expend through resistance training and even after through protein synthesis, which happens over time, over a couple of days. So you do keep the increase in energy expenditure elevated over time. But it really is more for preserving muscle and or enhancing it. And having some cardiovascular exercise can be beneficial as well. But again, you see shows like The Biggest Loser, and they're having people, so if you're doing 4, 5, 6 hours a day of exercise, you can lose a lot of weight. But how many people have the time and ability to do that. And by the way, even when you do that, most of those people become very overtrained. Mm. It's just not an efficient strategy and it's not effective over the long term. Mm. So really you want to, the goal should be to manage your calories, create an energy deficit, keep protein intake high. It's very important, especially during an energy deficit, to maintain lean mass. And that's roughly 2.2 kilograms per, I'm sorry, 2.2 kilograms of body weight of protein. Or if you want to look at lean mass anywhere between, which lean mass will go up as high as around 2.5 or so.
Right.
So if you're looking at it from, you shouldn't, when I talk about grams per kilogram, a lot of times people will misinterpret that as meaning their present body weight. But if you're over
fat, lean mass. Yeah.
You should be basing it on your lean, what your ideal body weight is, which is roughly 10% or so for a male, 20% for a female. And that comes out to around 2.5 grams per kilogram of protein per day.
Okay.
And then factor in the resistance training, which can be done in multiple ways. And I don't think the additional calories that you burn through circuit training, this is something I've come to change my opinion on over time. I just don't think it's that meaningful. I think that you're looking at minutiae in terms of the overall aspect of how many how much weight you'll lose from those types of things. And the focus should be really from a fat loss perspective on the nutrition. And then your resistance training should be on building muscle. And could you do a circuit? Yeah, if that's what you want to do. But I don't really think that is a overriding way to approach it.
So you changed your mind on that. You thought that circuits would actually be more effective than they were. You're putting less emphasis on their effectiveness. That's interesting.
Yeah, I thought training density, my feeling was that, and there's been evidence, so you do burn more. There is evidence that circuit training, but when you actually look at what the overall difference is, it's fairly slight. And I'm not clear, they haven't really done good studies on this, but I don't think the ultimate effects of resistance training on as far as the energy expenditure have to do with a period of days, because you're continuing to burn calories, if you will, by the increased muscle protein synthesis, which is an energy intensive process.
Right.
So what you're burning in that 1 hour of exercise, if it's an extra 60 calories through a circuit, how much difference does that make? And if you end up having greater energy expenditure through protein synthesis over time, I just think it's a wash. I don't say it's bad to do a circuit, but if your goal is maximal muscle, that's probably not a great strategy.
Mm. Yeah.
It's not the best strategy.
Well, I also think like maximum muscle is not like a – I think it's always a good starting point for most people. Most people, the physique that you would show them, that they'll be like, yeah, I want to look like that, or I want to get something closer to that. It generally is someone with a lot of muscle. And I just think that most people think they're going to peel all the body fat back and they're going to look like that. But they're kind of starting in the wrong point. You've got to build the physique underneath if you're not in shape, you know. And then when you peel it back, there will be that shape there. I think that a lot of, you know, at least the first world is in trouble, because we've popularized high intensity training as like this solution to weight loss and the solution to fitness. And that's why there's thousands and thousands of gyms that have popped up that are selling that as the answer to fitness. And I just think, what would have happened if thousands of these gyms took on, let's just say, bodybuilding, right? Let's just say it's something they have to sell. What if these thousands of gym franchises took on a bodybuilding method? We'd have a very different population walking around, at least fitness population. A lot of them, I think, would be probably not as overtrained. I think definitely less injured. And they would have ultimately, I think, better body composition. They'd put more emphasis on their nutrition, because a lot of that high intensity training, it's so brutal on the body. Like you mentioned earlier, they're overtrained, a lot of them, that they just go reaching for calories because they're exhausted. They're so fatigued. They're thinking to themselves, man, I just need to like wake myself up. I need to wake my brain up. I just need to go smash, I don't know, cookies and Gatorade, you know? And whereas if you do like a good bodybuilding session, yeah, it's fatiguing, but you don't necessarily just looking for absurd amounts of food. You're a little more, you haven't completely destroyed your brain. You haven't wiped yourself out. You haven't finished the workout on the floor at the end, unless obviously you're training like legs with John Meadows, but outside of that, not many people do. It's just, I think it's just a more sustainable way to train. It allows you to make smarter nutrition choices rather than, I am just so depleted, I need to put anything in my system to recover right now.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And when you say high intensity training, I assume you mean interval training, high intensity interval training?
Yeah, the F45, Orange Theory, you know, crazy high intensity circuits. I guess I wouldn't lump CrossFit necessarily into all of that, but traditionally how it started, yes, for sure.
I mean, there's a lot that goes on that I cringe at. I mean, one of my big hobby horses is seeing people use like plyometrics as a cutting exercise, you know, they give these high intensity plyometrics, like box jumps. And plyometrics is for power increases. And it just can be it's just not a very effective way to burn fat. But more importantly, it's just a very good way to get injured if you're doing it in the way that a lot of these people do. It's just not intended to be used in ways where you're having density of those types of high intensity plyometrics. Density of high intensity plyometrics is a recipe for injury because your form starts to degrade in exercises that are highly complex.
Mm. Yeah. Any multi joint movement that is like, yeah, loaded, especially in a fatigue setting, you are definitely asking for an injury for sure.
Particularly with ground reaction forces like jumps and box jumps, et cetera, depth jumps. Those can be very, very injurious. You're getting a lot of ground reaction forces that are applied to, especially when you're doing that with overweight people in particular, who already have predisposed to issues with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When it comes to the sort of the world, and we asked Brett Contreras this question, he had a kind of interesting answer for it, but I'll ask the same question to you. The stage world of bodybuilding where, you know, bodybuilding training, I'm all for it. However, the point where it turns into a sport, if you want to call it that, and they step on stage, right, and they begin the very, very extreme dieting. Do you think that, and it's very, you know, it's very romanticized. It's very popular. It's, you know, a lot of the videos get a lot of views, and a lot of these people that stand on the stage, in the bodybuilding world, which is the largest portion of the fitness industry, they're touted as heroes, and people hang off every word they say. How do you feel about that aspect of, say, like this? Let's just call it the sport of bodybuilding, where people train to get on stage. Do you feel like it's the industry would be better without it? Do you think there's stuff that we learn from it, from those extreme athletes, or you think just overall it's just worse for society?
It's a good question. I don't really look at it like that. What I would say is that it's because I was a bodybuilder myself, and I found it to be very uplifting going through the process. But with that said, it is very unhealthy. So while you're going, I found it very uplifting in the sense of looking back now and saying it was kind of a catharsis for me, and had positive effects on my own self-esteem. But it's an obsessive compulsive sport. It breeds unhealthy behaviors in general, and certainly for women even worse, because while men can get very low in body fat and not have necessarily any hormonal issue, although it does, I shouldn't say that. I mean, testosterone goes down, but usually that regulates. But when women do it and they lose their period, that has particularly detrimental aspects on health. But I mean, it screws up your hormones. Either sex, it screws up your hormones. Mm. Usually they're going to re-regulate over time, but still for women, when you're losing your period, that's a bad thing. And women can get bone issues because of that, depending upon how long they're competing, osteopenia, the beginnings of osteoporosis that can lead to issues later in life. A lot of people get mentally, just depends on the person, but there's the bigorexia, aspect where people always want to be big and they get all paranoid because they're smaller. Anyway, in a long-winded way, I would say that its effects on society, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know what I don't think the average person really cares. Bodybuilding and physique competition is a very niche sport that only people that are really into it are, you know, you have a small percentage of the population. I think the average female who has an eating disorder is not having that disorder because of figure competitors. Generally, right. It's because of the movie star who's rail thin
right.
and has no muscles. So I think that Hollywood has the bigger issue there.
That's a good point.
But I do think that that bodybuilding physique is not a healthy sport for the most part. It's going to – any extreme sport generally is not. And certainly getting down, having very, very low body fat levels and – yeah, you look good in pictures on stage, but if you actually even see the competitors one-to-one, they usually don't, they look drawn, their faces look drawn, usually mentally they want to eat the tablecloth on the table by the time they're finished with their competition. So anyway, I think that it's a good thing for a lot of people in terms of going through it, in terms of what it does for their self-esteem. For myself, being a skinny kid who developed his physique and was able to step on stage and win natural bodybuilding shows, it did a lot for my self-esteem. Mm. But I can see where it would have negative effects, and I think that's very individual.
Mm. Yeah, it does wholly come down to individual, like we were saying earlier. Some people can handle those kind of extremes and not have it overwhelm their life and ruin their relationships ongoing with food. But I feel like that person is a bit of a unique snowflake. Most people do develop some kind of eating disorder out of it. I know when I was doing a ton of training at one point, you know, doing 20-hour weeks, it just meant I could eat anything. I could just smash whatever I wanted. I didn't really have to think about the type of calories I was getting because I was having so many calories and I was so lean. I could just eat whatever I wanted. But then, you know, you peel back all the training, you're now down to 3 to 4 hours a week, and I've got all these bad habits where, you know, I walk into a grocery store, I walk into a petrol station and I think, yeah, I can just get that protein shake and, you know, buy that packet of chips and eat this chocolate. It's like now I have all these bad habits that I had to like reverse, and that was difficult. But it can easily happen to anyone. It's just it's having that awareness around it, I think, is super important.
I agree.
Coming back to some of the research, Brad, you posted some stuff from your lab that I was reading recently about a multi-joint versus single joint exercises for hypertrophy. And a lot of the stuff that you've seen in your lab is generally multi-joint. And I guess another way for people to think about it is like compound exercises, right? So like say a back squat versus like a leg extension, that they're seen better for muscle hypertrophy as opposed to the single joint exercises. However, there was something that just came up recently that you posted where the study revealed that the single joint did provide more muscle hypertrophy than the multi-joint, the compound exercise. And now this is kind of just one study, and you did kind of hypothesize that it could have been something to do with volume or something else as well. But in general, I guess you can comment on this and some of the research you've done. Compound exercises are usually your go-to in the beginning for hypertrophy over isolation exercises. Not that we're choosing one or the other, but just the majority of training in a program.
Yeah, so a couple of things. I want to just correct what you said in terms sure. of my own belief that multi-joint aren't better than single joint, that there's been a number of studies that shows that hypertrophy of a given muscle during multi-joint exercises there's no benefit. Some studies have shown that there's no benefit to performing single joint. Let's say a lat pull down. There's been some studies that show that biceps hypertrophy isn't better if you add in single joint exercises. I would say that multi-joint exercises are better for hypertrophy. Obviously, for a whole, they're going to tie in a lot more muscle mass. So a single multi-joint exercise is going to give you much more bang for your buck, if you will,
okay.
overall than a single joint exercise. But with that said, number one, that was equivocal as to whether adding single joints. Some studies have kind of showed there might be benefits to adding single joint. So a lot of that research hasn't been all that great. I'll give you a couple of things. Number one, as you just pointed out, the new study just came out clearly showing that for biceps hypertrophy, when they just looked at doing a dumbbell row, and it was a reverse grip, so it was supinated for the biceps,
yeah.
the biceps curl produced roughly double the hypertrophy in the biceps of a row. Our group, can't go into it too much because it's about to go into review,
okay.
but had similar, showed similar findings with the triceps. where single joint exercise was superior. But even then, it's kind of interesting that it depends on the heads of the triceps, that the multi-joint actually had beneficial effects in one of the heads to a greater degree, whereas your, because it depends on the exercise itself. And we looked at one single joint movement, and that had better effects on certain parts of the triceps and the overall triceps. So anyway, it's more of a complex topic. From what you just said, though, in the early stages of training, I do think that multi-joint is certainly the go-to. And overall, I generally think that you need a lot of multi-joint exercises just from an efficiency standpoint.
Right.
Because it's very inefficient. If you're going to use all single-joint exercises, you got to do a ton of different exercises to ultimately get proper hypertrophy, where you can cover a lot of bases with one exercise, like a squat, is going to give you a lot of bang for your buck. But look, a squat, it's been well documented that squats and leg presses, two very good multi-joint exercises, do not develop the rectus femoris muscle well, which is the middle muscle in the quadriceps, the part of the muscle in the quadriceps that goes down the midline of the muscle. And that leg extensions optimize hypertrophy of the rec fem. So if you just do squats or leg presses, you're going to be deficient in rectus femoris development in general, and adding in a leg extension. So it's combining. If your goal is, now it depends what your goals are.
Yeah, of course.
If your goals are just to get some strength and some muscle, it's probably not going to make a difference. Just doing squats and leg presses are going to be sufficient. If you're looking to be a physique competitor, bodybuilder, having delineation between your muscles and symmetry between all heads of the quads is very important. And similarly, like with the hamstrings, you're just not going to get good hamstring development through multi-joint exercise. You're just not. And that's been well documented. So if you want to truly develop the hams to a better degree, you're going to need to do isolated, either stiff-legged deadlifts, hamstring leg curls. And look, it's not even necessarily just for bodybuilders as far as hamstrings. There's been studies showing that the quadricep to hamstring ratio is a factor in terms of athletics in terms of injury risk to hamstring strains. So if you're quad dominant, where your quads are larger, substantially larger than your hamstrings, that you're at an increased risk. So anyway, I do think that it's more complex than probably we want to get into at this point. But I think in leaving it, the short answer to that is that combining multi-joint, single-joint exercises is optimal for certainly for hypertrophy and generally for sports performance as well.
Mm-hmm. Nice. You mentioned the ratio, the quad to hamstring, can it go the other way? Can you be at risk for a quad injury if, I don't know, many people that's hamstrings are much larger than their quads, but it's usually the other way around. But has there been any research in overdeveloped hamstrings versus quads? Which I don't know anyone who's done that, but potentially.
Not that I've seen, because I don't know. Overdeveloping your hamstrings is really not an easy thing. I have not seen that research, but hypothetically, I could say that might be the case. Yeah. Although the hamstrings are breaking, the function of the hamstrings, I'm not sure. But anyway, I've not seen any research on that, and I think that probably you're not going to see that, just because it's rare as hen's teeth to see someone that has highly overdeveloped hamstrings. And to get that, I think would be a real burden to try to get people to overdevelop their hamstrings.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think if anyone's overdeveloping hamstrings, it's probably running backs or some kind of explosive sport where they're doing a lot of hinging. Because some of those guys have ridiculous hamstrings. But thinking about it now, so they have the quads to match, but it's usually the overdeveloped quads, right? It's always because it's the muscles that you can see. It's always the muscles you see, you always overdevelop. It's just this, it's the problem with having mirrors in the gym, right? It's just that you always want to focus on what you can see.
Well, that's part of it. But again, the basic exercises for the lower body, for the legs, are your hip hinge moves, your squats, your leg press, your deadlifts, and just they're not really good hamstring. They tend to overdevelop. Those exercises tend to overdevelop the quads at the expense. And glute, they're good, generally good glute exercises as well. Mm. But the hamstrings, because of their biarticular function. They are obviously their knee flexors and hip extenders, and they just don't change their length much during multi-joint exercises, and thus just generally do not develop all that well. So unless you're doing a ton of isolation work, which very few people are going to do, it's just going to be very difficult to develop the hams, certainly overdevelop them vis-a-vis the quads.
Mm. Yeah, I know a lot of people struggle to train the hamstrings effectively. Like, I guess maybe a good indicator for a lot of people is they just never get sore hamstrings. And if they're doing an exercise which is supposedly a hamstring exercise, minus obviously the lying leg curl, like a multi-joint exercise, like a stiff leg deadlift or just a deadlift on the floor, where they, you know, they think they're going to get sore hamstrings, they just never do. One, I'd say probably their execution of the movement is not correct, but they just haven't explored enough hamstring exercises. There are just so many out there that people just never look into. Like the one we do a ton at our gym is kind of like a staggered single leg dumbbell deadlift, which just if you do it properly, it's one of the best hamstring exercises I reckon that's out there. And then I think most people call it like the Nordic curl, but basically you're just trying to like lock your feet in and just from the knee joint just kind of move your entire body, and that just rocks the hamstrings as well. And those two alone, if you want hamstring development, it's hard to go past those two. They're some of the best we've found, but most people never get that far. They just sit on the hamstring curl machine and that's kind of like hamstrings done, right? And then they try and train the deadlift, but they end up just training their lower back. So there's still a lot of work to be done there. Brad, before we jump into our final four questions, I wanted to ask you sort of a broader question about your work and your lab and your research. You know, maybe one day you'll hang up the lab coat and you'll call it a day.
I don't think that's ever going to happen. Okay. Retirement would not be something I have any interest in. I wake up every morning, Jack, to do what I do, and if that ever stops, I'm in trouble.
All right, I figured you might say that. So I had a backup question to that. So you were forced retirement. So something happened, and you no longer could do research. So they said, Brad, you know, I'm sorry that you're going to have to sideline this, and all the research was a wrap. What do you hope that the lab achieved? Like, from all the research that you've done, from all the amazing work that you spread throughout our communities and stuff, what do you hope, just in your mind, that was accomplished through your lab? Like, what developments do you hope we kind of achieved?
Well, first of all, and I think it's already happening, is pushing the research into hypertrophy forward. When I came into this field, that was really a focus of mine, because hypertrophy was always kind of the bastard child of strength and conditioning. Strength and conditioning has always been focused on performance aspects for athletics, and rightly so, because that's for your athletes. Hypertrophy is kind of a sidelight to developing strength and power, for the most part, unless you're a sumo wrestler or football lineman or something. But it kind of was never given proper credence. But I came into it as a personal training background and from a bodybuilding standpoint, and most look as a personal trainer. I'm not sure if you've ever done it, but people aren't coming to me and saying, I can count on one hand how many people would come in and say, you know, I want to add an inch to my my jump height, my vertical jump, or I want to come a second off my sprint. Now, athletes would come. I'm talking about the general population.
Yeah.
So in Gen Pop, when I trained athletes, there would be that is a focus. But Gen Pop, which is the majority of personal training clients for most people, and certainly the general public who makes up that population, is focused on getting bigger and losing body fat.
Of course.
And my focus was, I was saying, you know what, there's really very little research in this, I started to realize, and also very little research in trained subjects. They usually were looking at untrained subjects. So hopefully that is happening. I know it's happening already, and it'll continue to happen, that we're now having a much bigger focus on what the general population wants from their training, just to get bigger and reduce body fat, and to have more evidence-based information on this. And the other thing that I would hope that is, and this is not only from my research, but just through my own endeavors in social media and speaking and doing these types of podcasts, but is to promote evidence-based practice. Because, look, I grew up a bro. I grew up during the time of the Weider magazines. really before the internet became a thing. And we would have like Muscle and Fitness magazine and Flex, which isn't even in business anymore. But I would devour those magazines, reading the routines of the stars of the early 90s, bodybuilding stars like Lee Haney, Lee Labrada, Rich Gaspari, and then into Dorian Yates, that whole 90s era. And just routine hopping and listening to what they said about, and, yeah. and certainly that I'm not disparaging that, that's beneficial, but if you just follow the result, the routines of the biggest bodybuilders like I did, you hit a plateau very quickly because you don't have their genetics and you don't have their pharmacology. Mm. So really my goal now is to promote the importance of evidence-based practice, to make people understand that there's nothing mystical about research studies and that they can be, even if you're not good at interpreting them, you can follow people who do have an understanding. Some of my colleagues, I mean, Breckenridge, as you mentioned before, is top of the food chain. Eric Helms, there's just so many. My colleague James Krieger and others. There's so many really good, I don't want to leave people out. I just go on and on, like Lee Norton. But if you follow people who are evidence-based and follow a bunch of them, because I have certain opinions, you're going to always be have certain biases based on your upbringing and your experiences, your genetics, et cetera, and other factors. So if you follow a broad-based number of evidence-based practitioners, that you're going to ultimately get you can synthesize those views and try to understand what kind of get a feeling for the totality of what people think and make decisions. And hopefully I've helped to enhance people's understanding of the importance of evidence-based practice. And it's, again, something that I have learned the hard way, that you can't just follow the bro. You can't just be a bro and expect to optimize your own genetics.
Yeah.
Unless you just happen to have great genetics and then you'll respond to anything. But for the majority of people, if you want to opt, and even for people who are the biggest bros, I mean, I've worked with elite bodybuilders, like pro bodybuilders, and helped them get beyond where they were before. Just because you have great genetics, you'll look incredible and you can win shows, but that doesn't mean you're optimizing your genetics. And to optimize genetics really does involve more of a scientific approach. And certainly, the less genetically gifted you are, the more important that becomes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really well said. Yeah, there's the vast majority of people that want to train. Like you said, they want to reduce body fat and build muscle. And if people that have made the mistakes in the past can help them not make those mistakes, then guess that's what it's all about, right? Just being more effective, more efficient, just getting more out of your training. That's really good. So, Brad, we'll jump into the first question. The first question is the interview question. So, if you had an opportunity to sit down and interview anyone that is alive today, who would you pick and why?
So, the key is that's alive today, because there's so many people who are not alive that I would love to interview, like Abraham Lincoln and Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein. Not as many that are alive today. One that just really fascinates me is Howard Stern, the broadcaster. I'm not sure if they have him in Australia, but he's always fun. I listened to him a lot early when I was younger, and so I've gotten old. I just haven't had time anymore, but I've still followed him, and he's just, to me, a really interesting individual. I'd be very interested to hear about his transition, because you know, when I listened to him, he was this kind of crazy. He would look to do just, you know, outrageous things, and he's now progressed, and I've actually seen to a real serious interviewer, and kind of be, to me, very interesting to get into the psychology of how his progression over time as a human being and how he has evolved. And anyway, I find him a fascinating character.
Yeah, I actually just watched something on him recently. He did a really good interview. There's a new series on Netflix. I want to say, I can't remember the name of it. I think it's called like another interview or Tonight's Interview or something. And it's with David Letterman, I believe. He started like he's back, because he did the, what was it, Saturday Night Live for ages or something like that in America. I'm not sure what it was.
I know he did Letterman.
Oh, Letterman. Yeah, I guess.
I don't know whether he did Saturday Night Live, but certainly Letterman, he was a regular guest on when he was early in his career.
Yeah. And yeah, there's like the new Netflix series, and he's like, he's back. It's Letterman and Stern. They do like a talk from stage, an interview from stage for like an hour and a half, I think. It's really good. It's really good, and it like recaps his whole journey through everything. Yeah, it was one of the best, because I love Howard Stern as well, and it's one of the best interviews he's done for a while. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I think that was a good answer. First time we've had Howard Stern, so I like it. Second question is, what is something that you do every day, Brad, or you try to do every day that you feel like really is integral to success of the day? If you don't do it, you don't feel like the day was as complete.
Eating a good breakfast.
Mm.
I cannot go without. If I do not have breakfast in the morning, I'm a zombie. So I guess I know there are people that just, and I think the body is very adaptive, where if I wouldn't do it over a period of time, but
sure.
I am so entrenched in eating like I still eat kind of a bro breakfast of an omelet with a cheese omelet and oatmeal with some raisins and a cup of coffee.
Nice.
But I need my breakfast. And if I don't have that, yeah, that will mess up my day.
Have you been to Australia before, Brad? Have you had
Sydney.
Have you been? Have you had a? When were you here? What year was it?
3 years ago, I think.
Okay.
Now.
So you would have had it. You probably would have had a chance to have an Australian breakfast and coffee.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay.
I do know that when I've been in the UK, they have like baked beans, and that's just going. You know, it's baked beans is not a breakfast for me. So I have had some trouble when I'm in the UK.
Right.
I don't remember. I don't remember it was bad. So
yeah,
I've been in so many countries that they kind of blur into
each other. Yeah, fair enough.
With the different foods.
Yeah, yeah. I heard you do like an interview in Portugal or something, and I just thought to myself, this guy's been everywhere. But yeah, if you get the chance to come back to Australia, there's we're becoming internationally famous in the food world for our eggs and our coffee. So it's definitely something that you should try next time. Make more of a conscious effort to go to somewhere good. There's okay. So third question, is there anything recently? Now, I've discussed a few of these things, but maybe something else comes to mind. Something recently you changed your mind on that for a while you held as a strong belief?
I mean, I'm constantly changing my beliefs to varying degrees. I can go through a litany. If you're talking training-wise, I mean, nutrition-wise as well. But one of the ones I talk about a lot, and that I've a lot of it was through my own research, was that you could not build muscle with lighter loads.
Right.
Our group has carried out, it was a colleague of mine, Stuart Phillips from McMaster University, a really terrific researcher, was carrying out some studies. He did one with muscle protein synthesis and then did a longitudinal study showing that these very light loads, like 30% 1RM, talking 30 reps, would be able to build, and it was building similar muscle, but they were an untrained subject. And I was like, you know what, Stu? I said, I'm going to carry out a study in trained subjects. I said, untrained subjects, they get jacked from doing spin cycling, from cardio. And you watch, the trained subjects will not build muscle. And I carried it out. Lo and behold, they gained just as much muscle from the light loads. And it's been shown over and over. We've done meta analyses, and just more and more research is coming out. So you can build up to a certain point, you can build, there's a minimum threshold, certainly, where below it starts to become almost aerobic. But at least with 30, 35, even 40 repetitions, you can build appreciable muscle on a whole muscle level that's similar to heavy loads.
Mm.
And I think that's big. Again, I could go through a lot more, but that's really big because it frees up the thought process that people have joint-related issues. Because people just can't use heavy loads. That it's just, especially elderly, but
yeah,
people were injured as well. And that lifting light loads can achieve similar results is a very important finding.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. I think even there's a lot of new research coming out with blood flow restriction as well that are kind mm-hmm. of going down that path as well, like even lighter loads, right, because of the cuffs. Just to kind of stay on that point, I just brought up something that you posted recently. It says, the true fitness professional is always curious yet always skeptical. Most importantly, he's willing to put aside personal biases aside and change his opinion when emerging evidence becomes sufficiently compelling. And I think that's exactly what you said. You're always changing your mind because, hey, exactly. You find one thing, but after a while, you're a scientist, right? If the evidence is there, you just can't ignore it. So that's really good.
Yeah, and I just want, you know, when you bring that up, I think it's very important to point out, people just are afraid to admit they're wrong. Yeah. And it's like, you know, I've just changed my whole life. Like if I look back to when I was younger, just the beliefs, a lot of the beliefs I held just in general in life, but certainly beliefs I held towards fitness, clinging to beliefs that have been debunked basically is silly. It's just because you held those beliefs and you feel, oh, I don't want to like admit that I'm wrong. No one cares. It's people respect you. You know, if you say, hey, look, this is what I thought. I misinterpreted evidence is what I thought. It's one thing even to say, you know what, that's what the evidence showed, which was the case with a lot of things. But those things that I just was not a good scientist when I, you know, you've got 20 years ago, yeah, when I was first getting into this field, shows you how long I've been around. but more than 20 years, I just was not a good enough scientist. I would cherry pick evidence. I wanted to believe certain things, and I would see research that showed something, and I would cling on to that. Mm. And the stuff that the research that didn't support what I believed, I would dismiss that. I'd say, well, look at this research, you know, and I would convince myself that this is what I'd want to do. And it's just, it's when you understand, as I've gotten not only more mature and older, but as I've gotten much more entrenched in research as well as in schooling, going through my master's degree and PhD, which really is so important. I think that's a problem with the internet in general, is that you get a lot of people who are trying to interpret research and understand and using research like I was, without the training to do it. It's it leads to that type of thinking. And I wish someone would have told me this back then and would have convinced me. I'm not sure I would have been open to listening to myself in my younger years in terms of this. But I would just hope that anyone listening, if they're in that boat, would understand that it's not about being right, it's about getting it right.
Mm. That's awesome. Yeah, it's the ego. It's a powerful thing, right? It protects us even when we don't want the protection. So, no, really good point. Final question, Brad, is there any book or a quote that is front of mind or something that you really like that you want to share with the listeners?
Yeah, so I have a tattoo. I don't know, can you see that?
Yeah, I got it. Nice.
So, that Chinese? Is knowledge. It's Chinese writing. It's knowledge is power.
Nice.
In Chinese. And that is the motto that I live by. Knowledge is power. And it guides my entire existence, that I look to continue to learn every day. I learn through my readings. I learn through my interactions. I learn through my students. I tell my students, challenge me and ask questions and things. Not a day goes by, I think, where I don't learn something. And you have to make an effort to do that. I devour learning. I'm not someone who just sits back and lies on the beach somewhere, which you can tell by my white skin. I'm constantly looking to improve myself, and that's what gives me power, and I think that's what gives humans power. That's what separates us from the animal species, that we are learning beings and that we continue to evolve. And hopefully every year you get better. You might get older, you know, you might get a little grayer in the hair and get a couple more wrinkles, but up here, knowledge-wise, you're more evolved as a human.
Mm.
And anyway, that's how I live my life, and I try to impart that to others.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, you couldn't have said it better. I like that you tattooed that on your body as well. So it's a lot of commitment, and it's true. It's true. Knowledge is definitely power. Brad, this has been an amazing show. I've really appreciated your time and having you on. Where can people find out more information about you? You've got some books people can pick up as well. They can follow you on Instagram. Just what's the best place to find you?
Yeah, so I'm all over social media. They can just Google me. But yeah, I'm on Twitter. My primary, I'm Twitter, Instagram. Instagram's probably my primary one, but Twitter, do a lot of research. Facebook, to some extent, I'm still on there, although their algorithms suck now. So
does suck.
I'm a little less, but certainly all the social media, you could just search me and you'll find me. I have a website called Look Great Naked, which I have a blog, which I need to update more. But I have a lot of free information on there. And yeah, I have books. I have a textbook, which I'm really proud of, called The Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy. And I have some consumer books as well. So the textbook obviously is more technical, and the consumer books like I've Max Muscle Plan and Storm and Sculptor are two recent ones I did that both have plans for that are easily followed by consumers.
Yeah, awesome. Brad, thank you so much for being on. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, bud.
My Mars Project, thank you for tuning into this episode with Brad Schoenfeld. If you enjoyed it, please share the love. Do not hesitate. Do not keep this good stuff for yourself. Okay, pump it out to everyone on your socials. Take a screenshot, tag Brad, tag us, and we will absolutely show you back some love. We will share it as well. And guys, remember at the start of this show, we talked about our two sponsors, Whoop. If you want to pick up the Whoop band and start monitoring everything in your life, from your sleep, your recovery, the calories burned, your daily strain, which is just kind of an indicator of how hard you've been worked aerobically through the day, then go to whoop.com and use our code MINDMUSCLE. You're going to save 15% off. And it did land in Australia, so all Aussies can pick it up now as well. And then guys, of course, you can go to trueprotein.com.au, pick up the True Protein bars. When you use the code MINDMUSCLE10, you get a 10% discount. All right, thanks guys. We'll speak to you next week.